This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Marden are just moments away to discuss fact, fiction, and flying saucers, the truth behind the misinformation, distortion, and derision by debunkers, government agencies, and conspiracy con men. My good friend Victor Vigiani from Zealand News Network is with me in studio. We'll get to him in just a moment. First, let me introduce the band. On the Gibson Flying V guitar, my fine rockabilly friend Ian Robertson is on the other side of the glass, twisting the knobs and dials. And on the Rickenbacker bass guitar, and occasionally the theremin, Albert Vinzel. Hello, Albert. How are you? Albert is here running our HOA, our Hangout on Air. And if you want to watch this radio transmission streamed live on YouTube, here's what you do. You go to my Twitter feed, at Richard Serrett, S-Y-R-E-T-T, at Richard Serrett. Go to the top or near the top of the Twitter feed, find the tweet containing the link to the HOA, click, and voila. Abracadabra, presto, change-o. You'll see me here in studio. And Victor and Albert, and occasionally we even have some guests up on webcam as well. Now it is time, very quickly, for a little segment we like to call What's in the Box, where my story producer, occasional remote viewer, Albert Vinzel, attempts to transcend time and space and determine the contents of this beautiful vintage humidor sitting on our desk here in Liberty Village. So, Albert, I know you've been concentrating, you've been following the remote viewing protocols. What is in the box, Albert?
All right, I'm going to guess the jogging. I guess jogging or someone jogging, like red, something heart healthy.
Something heart healthy. Someone jogging. It's a box, Albert. I'm not following you. What do you mean someone jogging?
Maybe somehow related to jogging, like a squeeze ball.
Something
or
related
like
to jogging. Oh, I see.
Timer
okay.
Or something like that. A pedometer or something.
I gotcha. Okay, we're just going to let that sit there. We'll reveal a little bit later in the program. And incidentally, if those of you listening at home, maybe following us on our HOA, if you want to take a stab at utilizing your remote viewing skills, what's the hashtag we're using, Albert?
TCS remote.
All right, hashtag TCS, as in The Conspiracy Show, hashtag TCS remote. And you can tweet us and, again, determine what's in the box, and we'll do the reveal a little bit later in the program. All right, let me crib from the back here of fact, fiction, and flying saucers. It's no secret that the mainstream media has misinformed us for years about UFO studies conducted by highly regarded scientists at the finest universities in the country. The U.S. government has covered up the alien presence through misinformation, distortion, obfuscation, and ridicule. Some prominent politically connected scientists and professional writers have even participated in the cover-up. In fact, fiction and flying saucers, Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin examine the wealth of archival documents that clearly demonstrate this cooperative disinformation effort and refute the false claims made by these professional scoffers. Friedman and Martin set the record straight by examining politically motivated misinformation and presenting the compelling evidence that separates fact from fiction. Before we get to Stanton and Kathleen, first let me welcome Victor Vigiani back to the program. Victor is the executive director of Zealand Communications News Network, and the website is zlandcommunications.blogspot.ca. Victor, hello, how are you?
Just great to be with you. Just fine, thanks.
Do you know what's in the box?
A pedometer or a can of beans or something? That's a tough one.
All right. We'll get to that a little bit later. Stanton Friedman is a nuclear physicist who worked on a wide variety of advanced classified nuclear systems for major industrial companies. He began the civilian investigation of the Roswell incident, wrote Flying Saucers and Science and Top Secret, Magic, and co-authored Crash at Corona, Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, and Science Was Wrong. He's appeared on hundreds of radio and TV programs. He resides in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada. Stanton Friedman, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I'm delighted to be here.
And we are delighted to have you. Kathleen Martin is a best-selling author, award-winning UFO researcher and lecturer, and a frequent guest on radio programs. Her expert testimony has been featured on the History, Discovery, National Geographic, Destination America channels. She is co-authored of Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, Science Was Wrong, and The Alien Abduction Files. She resides near Orlando, Florida. Kathleen, welcome to you.
Thanks. It's great to be with you tonight.
Excellent. All right. First of all, let me both ask you, putting together this book. Now, this is you two have collaborated on a number of projects together. What is it? What makes for a good co-author? I mean, why did you find Kathleen to be sort of your dance partner, Stanton, and Kathleen the same for you? Why Stanton?
Well, pretty straightforward, actually. We'd met. I had gotten involved in the Betty and Barney Hill story. A television program, television station in Pittsburgh, I was living in Pittsburgh at the time, and had begun my public career, if you will, by an appearance on KDKA, which has a wide audience, the biggest station in town. And I was on a show, believe it or not, called Contact several times. And they apparently liked what I presented. There was a group called UFO Research Institute there, and I was a member of that group. And they called me to let me know that Betty and Barney Hill were coming to town. I'd read the book, The Interrupted Journey by John Fuller. And I read the Look magazine articles and was very intrigued. That was the first abduction case that got any publicity. And so I was intrigued, especially by the star map, and wound up being involved in trying to figure out what that means. Anyway, they not only told me that Betty and Barney were coming to town and were going to be on a particular program, but they told me where they were staying, which is very unusual, as I'm sure you're aware, and I contacted them. We had dinner together. So it gave me a person-to-person chance to evaluate them, see whether they were enlarging upon what was in the book, and I was very favorably impressed. Well, Kathy, which you haven't mentioned, is Betty's niece.
Right.
And it
right.
was because of that connection that we met. And we saw each other at conferences, MUFON conferences and stuff. And we found, I shouldn't say this, but I will, we're both Leos. We have an approach toward let's get the facts straight before putting our mouths in gear and our pens in hand, so to speak. And we found that we worked extremely well together. So, you know, we started appearing together at conferences. We heard each other speak and so forth. And she asked me if I wanted to do something on Captured about the star map. And I did. I very much wanted to do that. And so the Science Was Wrong followed because we both had a concern about getting the facts straight. In ufology, there's too darn much research by proclamation rather than investigation.
Right, you
got
that right.
We believe in going to the archives and looking at the documents and digging out the facts instead of proclaiming, well, it's probably like this or like that. And we see a lot of that in ufology and in every field.
Right.
People are too lazy, for one thing. It's hard work. And it costs some money, too, traveling. I live on the East Coast. Kathy lives in not far from Orlando. And the Presidential Archives are some distance from there, and the National Archives are some distance. So I've had, I will admit, some research grants from the Fund for UFO Research and from Robert Bigelow. Those really come in handy because there isn't a lot of money available to cover costs.
No, that's true. How about you? For you, Kathleen?
Well, I first asked Stanton to work with me on Captured because he was the scientist who was able to find other scientists who were willing to evaluate Marjorie Fish's work on Betty's star map. She had been able to identify the stars on Betty's map, and Stanton had promoted that work. He had published on it, and so I wanted a co-author who would be willing to write a couple of chapters on the star map, and he said that he would be willing to do so. That gave me the opportunity to get to know Stanton as a person, and we began to discuss writing a second book together, Science Was Wrong, in which each of us would write half of the book. We each wrote seven chapters. The qualities that Stanton has that I like are that he is a meticulous researcher. He doesn't embellish his facts. He is personable. He has a great sense of humor, so it can become rather tense writing a book, but it's great that we can laugh together as we're doing it. So I really enjoy that part of it. He's done a great deal of research in archival collections, and it interests me greatly. I had to travel to some archival collections myself, and he joined me during one of those trips, so we had the opportunity to do our research together as well. When I went alone, I shared my files with him. I had photographed or photocopied many, many files, probably up to 1,000 pages, just for this book alone. And he had stacks of archival documents as well that he was willing to send to me and give to me. So we found that we work very well together. We have similar writing styles. We enjoy writing what could be a boring history book and making it into a very exciting, easy-to-read book that will be entertaining and keep people's attention. That's something that we seem to do well together.
You certainly do. Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, the latest. Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Martin, Victor Vigiani in studio. When we come back, one of the things that jumped out at me immediately in this book is, you know, people are always demanding evidence and so forth. Never mind the documents. What about hard evidence? And you point out there are over 5,000 cases where physical evidence actually has been recovered, and we'll talk about that and much more when we come back. Victor Vigiani in studio from Zealand News Network, Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Martin on the other side here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
Shaking the world and seeing what falls. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. The truth will set you free, but first, it will really tick you off. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Just a programming note. Next week, Scott Bennett on WikiLeaks
And Marty Leeds on Math Magic next week on The Conspiracy Show. Right now, Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin stay with us. Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. Victor Vigiani in studio. We'll get to him in a moment. But I wanted to follow up on something I mentioned before the break. And this is just a real eye-opener right out of the – it's right in the introduction here. You cite 5,000 reports collected of physical trace cases from 89 countries. 5,000 reports of physical trace cases. What are we talking about when we say physical trace cases?
Well, the person who did that work in particular is a man named Ted Phillips. He was a protege of Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was the Air Force, an astronomer, chairman of the department at Northwestern University, and the Air Force scientific consultant of Project Blue Book for 19 years. And he got Ted involved, and he's collected these reports, and it's helped that Allen let people know that if you have such a report, let him know and talk to Ted, contact him. And the thing is, they come from 80 countries, and we're talking about people who are close to a saucer on the ground, either sitting on the ground or just above the ground. And some of the physical traces that are found include small footprints, burn circles, burn rings, landing gear marks, that sort of thing. And quite frankly, after you've read your first 200 such cases, it's dull. Same thing is happening all over the world. Same reports. Ted has visited hundreds of these cases, incidentally, these sites. And so people think, or the nasty, noisy negativists, as I like to call them when I'm being polite, think that we only have lights in the sky seen from a long ways away, and who knows what they are. Not at all. Many of these cases are, these objects are observed within 100 feet. There's no mistaking, there's a long, big difference between a light in the sky thousands of feet away and an object sitting on the ground just less than 100 yards, less than 100 feet from you. So you have to look at these cases to what's going on here. The objects are consistently the landed objects are less than 100 feet in diameter. We're not talking about motherships here. We do have reports of motherships. I remember one case that civil engineer was able to triangulate by talking to enough witnesses. The object was between 6/10 and 1 mile long. These aren't the things that are seen on or near the ground. And people who say that sounds weird, remember that the United States has aircraft carriers, huge ships, that can nuclear-powered ones that can operate for 18 years without refueling. They carry about 75 small airplanes, which can operate for, maybe up to 2 hours on a good day before they need to be refueled. So we have a mothership, if you will, and a little Earth excursion module, I'd like to call them that. So that's a very good place to start. Also, because a lot of these cases involve radar and visual, ground radar, airborne radar. You can't say there's nothing there.
Right, right. The Stephenville Lights is a great example where you have, you have radar, you have, what do they call those, paint skins, right?
Yeah.
Let's get Victor Vigiani in here. Victor?
How you doing, Stanton?
Hi.
Yeah, good to talk to you again. I just want to bring up a point regarding, two respected groups that have really taken a perspective on this. Number one is MUFON. There's a lot of finger-pointing going on now towards MUFON to become more engaged with stating the facts as they know them are, as they know they are, in terms of the political implications of these kinds of things, that MUFON's just not standing up and saying, let's look at the facts. And then there's another group of pilots. The pilots are seeing these things on a daily basis, and they're restricted in their perception and how they can even begin to talk about it. How do you see those two groups folding in to at least highlight some of the things that you point out as disinformation or information itself?
Well, let's face it, there have been literally thousands of pilot sightings. The problem is pilots don't want to stick their necks out because they're afraid of losing their job. And so there is an organization to which they can report their sighting without having their name be attached to it. Somebody has the rules, if you will, the entry books. And Dr. Richard Haynes is the primary scientist of this group. He worked for NASA, was a scientist for NASA for many years. And he has written some books about pilot sightings, say, in Southeast Asia and in other places. And, you know, I fly a lot. I sure hope that the guy who's running that airplane knows what's going on around him and keeps his eyes open and avoids any problems with an unplanned interaction with another vehicle. So I tend to trust pilots, especially when you get a consistency of reports, the behavior as well as the appearance. You know, we don't have, so far as we know, airplanes that can start, stop, move straight up, straight down, silently, make right angle turns without slowing down first and then speeding up after they make the turn. Obviously, such characteristics would be great for military systems. If we had them, we'd use them. And there have been a few wars in which we have used airplanes. And so I think I like pilot sightings. I'm not saying pilots are infallible. Nobody's infallible. But, you know, the question isn't, are all UFO sightings alien spacecraft? The question is, are any? And our answer is yes, very definitely. They're manufactured vehicles that haven't been made on Earth. That means they come from someplace else. Very straightforward.
Let me work Kathleen Martin in here. And Kathleen, when debunkers talk about things like UFOs, ETs, they talk about and we're talking about the nature of the cover up here. They always say, how do you keep something like that secret? Well, there's a wonderful example in here that I've often used with people in terms of, you know, how you keep a conspiracy quiet, and that has to do with things like the Manhattan Project. Can you just expand on that a little bit? It's a wonderful example.
Yes. You have to realize that there are different levels of secrecy. And so secret information can be made public. It can be declassified. Top secret information is sometimes declassified. But when you get to top secret code word, that is the kind of information that you can get on a need-to-know basis only. And you have to have the clearance to go to that information if you need it. That's the kind of information that the public cannot gain access to. And those people who are involved in this, who have the clearances, will not reveal that information. They don't tell their wives. Stanton Friedman, for example, had a Q clearance, which was a secret clearance, a top secret clearance, when he was a nuclear physicist. He had information in the programs that he was developing. He couldn't tell his wife. He didn't know who his wife would talk to. You can't tell your friends without telling your enemies. And you could get into a tremendous problem for your country, for yourself, for your family. Not only that, but it is against the law. Violators could face up to several years in prison and heavy fines as well. So the individuals who hold these secrets have to prove that they are very, very loyal to their company, to their country, and that they will not reveal the secret information.
I think the example that you cite in the book as it refers to the Manhattan Project is, you know, some of the wives who were wondering what their husbands who were involved, the scientists in the Manhattan Project, were doing, and they were strongly urged to listen to the radio on August 6, 1945, and that's how they found out what their husbands had been up to.
That is correct. So, you know, another example of the fact that secrets can and will be kept.
Actually, one of the things that I wanted to try to shed some light on, Kathleen, is this idea of the incredible amount of secrecy that you have discovered, both you and Stanton have clearly discovered that exists. It means it's a monolith, I mean, let's look at it clearly for what it is. It's a monolith. So, I mean, there's always this point of view that it's self-evident to me anyway, is that if you've got this kind of information at your disposal, and you say, well, it doesn't exist, well, why does the secrecy exist? They seem to be two separate entities, the issue itself and the secrecy. Do you see what I'm getting at? Why all the secrecy if there's nothing there?
Absolutely. Well, and we have shown evidence that this information is being covered up, not only at the official level through Air Force Regulation 200-2, for example, that was a Project Blue Book regulation that stated that the Project Blue Book would inform the news media on UFOs only when they had been positively identified as familiar objects. The names of the people involved, intercept, and investigation procedures were classified, and radar data was classified and could not be revealed. That was put into effect in 1953. Then in 1954, we had the Joint Army Navy Air Force Regulation number 146. You might think of it as JNAP 146, where mm-hmm. it became a crime for the military personnel to discuss classified UFO reports with unauthorized persons. Violators faced up to 2 years in prison and fines up to $10,000. That was after the Robertson panel made the decision to cover up the information that the government had discovered in their studies on UFOs.
Would you think, Kathleen, that the fact that there's a secret around an issue, does that not prove its existence?
Well, let me just jump in there. If you want to see proof of this, just look at the 156 top secret Umbra NSA, National Security Agency, UFO documents that got released way back in the 80s. You can read one sentence per page. Everything else is whited out. And now if you try to get a set of these, gee whiz, we can't find the originals, they said. About the same time, we found many dozens of CIA top secret Umbra UFO documents. They're all blacked out. And people say, well, why don't you just scrape off the black? Well, you get a Xerox. You don't get the original documents. And, you know, anybody, I can guarantee you, will laugh at my lectures when I show these, because they're real. Another example to indicate the magnitude of the problem is Lockheed developed the stealth aircraft. They spent $10 billion over 10 years in secret. We didn't know until they were finished the development, so to speak. And so... and also, I better add here, I've had people challenging, well, Stan, all that stuff's on the computer. You can just sit at your desk and look at all those files. What are you talking about here? Well, you can't. Most of this stuff is not on the computer. It hasn't been scanned in. The files that I've been to 20 archives, and believe me, there's tons, and I mean that literally, of paper at these archives. You can't just sit at your computer because the stuff hasn't been scanned. So you got to put some effort into it. And the government, the journalists haven't. And we better add in something else here. Back in the 70s, there was a thing called the Church Committee. Senator Frank Church, United States Senate, they did an investigation about the media and the CIA. And much to everybody's surprise, it turned out there were hundreds of reporters that had a connection with the CIA.
Mockingbird. That was Operation Mockingbird, wasn't it?
Well, there were several different operations. And the thing is that some of the publications, Life and Time, for example, were proud of the fact that their reporters were, helping out on national security. There were other organizations where a connection was not able to be publicized at all. But it came as quite a shock to people. I had a contract way back in the early 60s to look at Soviet work with regard to compact nuclear reactors for space vehicle applications. And the place that has tons of Soviet research that's been translated is Patel Memorial Institute. And while I was visiting there for my contract, I correctly predicted that the Russians would be putting nuclear reactors in space. I found comments from scientists who'd been traveling and somehow would make a report when they got back, what they heard at conferences, what Soviet scientists were saying.
Stanton, excuse my interruption. I got a break here. We'll pick up on that point when we come back. Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucer. Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Martin, Victor Vigiani in studio. Back with more in a moment. Stay with us.
When in doubt, blame the government. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Don't be afraid of the dark. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To talk to Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-740-4740.
All right, welcome back. Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin are with us. Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, and Victor Vigiani from Zealand News Network in studio. We're tight for time. I want to get to sort of another more overt way of sort of keeping a lid on this whole arena, and that has to do with direct threats to UFO researchers. Kathleen, you had some interesting findings that you've published in this book. I mean, I think you profiled or mentioned 18 specific cases of UFO researchers, and virtually all of them had been either threatened or had computers tampered with. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yes, I decided to do in sort of an informal questionnaire that I sent out to a number of UFO researchers who were fairly prominent, and also to experiencers who had gone public with their stories and were speaking on the lecture circuit. And almost everyone told me that they had been tampered with, that had either received veiled threats, some had received direct threats, their computers might have had the latest, very good antivirus software, and they were hacked and they were destroyed. There were all sorts of things. Sometimes people's homes were broken into, and I was surprised at this. The reason that I asked that is that I was speaking at a conference and a man made some veiled threats towards me. And so I wanted to know how widespread this was, and found out that it really was quite widespread.
But that kind of resistance, I guess, is to be expected to some degree. You know, it's an understanding that we all have, but I'd like to kind of take it in a different direction. The evolution of this whole concept of the abduction phenomenon, and going back into the 50s and what it was to begin, and how it was portrayed then, and how it's evolved since you know, Bud's work, and even since Dr. Mack's work. How do you see the whole idea of these, whatever they are, these beings somehow tampering with the human species? And it seems to be quite direct and indisputable. How do you see that phenomenon evolving and its history affecting where we go?
Well, when Bud was alive and was researching this, he took a rather negative view upon all of it. And of course, Dr. Mack took a more positive view toward it. But Bud was focusing upon what appeared to be a longitudinal genetic study where these beings were abducting humans and taking genetic material, reproductive material, and growing these sort of hybrid beings in gestational tanks and somehow raising them somewhere on a craft or on a base. And that is very distressing when you think that the humans have not consented to do this, have not consented to take part in any kind of experiment, and they are being experimented on like lab rats. That certainly is not something that the government would want the general population to know about, because our military and no military force on this world can retaliate. No one can protect experiencers from having these experiences. At the same time, the trend that we're heading in now is that many of these experiencers are stating that they had made a contract to participate in this, and that all of this is an effort to raise human consciousness, and that it is for a positive purpose. So that's sort of a shift in attitude. Although David Jacobs still contends that these ETs are doing it for the purpose of taking over the Earth, he believes, and that they are already moving hybrids into apartments in New Jersey and perhaps elsewhere. But that is not consistent with the general trend, the information that I'm receiving. I'm MUFON's Director of Experiencer Research, and I'm also on the board of directors of the Edgar Mitchell Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters. I've been doing this research for a very long time, and I'm finding these new trends very, very interesting. There are still individuals who are claiming that they are having highly negative experiences and being mistreated, but it seems to be a much smaller percentage of individuals than it has been in the past, whereas others are moving toward this consciousness-raising trend.
All right, well, this is a short segment. We'll take a time out, come back, and we'll get into some of the debunkers, the great debunkers that you both tackle in Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, people like Dr. Howard Menzel and Philip J. Klass. We'll do that when we come back. We'll also grab a call or two, if time permits. Victor Vigiani, Zealand News Network in studio, Stanton Friedman and Kathleen Martin on the phone. Again, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. More on The Conspiracy Show right after this.
When you look at the sky, ever wonder if someone's looking back? This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard live, call 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Curiosity, or did the devil make you do it? Whatever the reason, welcome back to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio. To All talk right. to Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
All right, we'll get back to Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Martin in just one second. I just want to wrap up what's in the box, and a number of people have tweeted using the hashtag TCS remote, and someone thought it was a pyramid-shaped yellow or gold object. Someone mentioned a silver chain bracelet, a Sidney Crosby hockey card. No one's really close, although the silver object is the silver chain bracelet is somewhat close. Albert, let's reveal what's in the box, shall we? And then we'll move on. Okay, open that up. And there we go. It's a harmonica or a mouth organ. All right. Nobody really close this week, but we'll try that again next week, time permitting. What's in the box? All right, Stanton Friedman, Kathleen Martin, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. Let's grab a quick call. Dave has been patient. He's been waiting from New Jersey. Dave, good evening. Welcome.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to speak with you again. Thank you so much.
All right. You called in last week, and you were anxious to speak with Stanton this week. So you've got the floor. Very quickly, your question.
No, first, Dr. Friedman, I just want to tell you what an honor it is to finally speak with you. I've been following your work for 30 years. I had a question regarding some information I discovered called the Mark IV Control Display System, a vehicle that from July 1960, Lear Corporation was developing for the U.S. Air Force, ARDC, and WADD. Only thing I was ever able to find is I cross-referenced from the same month of July 1960 in a magazine called Aviation Week and Space Technology. It also speaks and has pictures about this Mark IV vehicle that is in production from another company called Avco, A-V-C-O.
Yeah.
I just was wondering, was that something that went black or was never developed, or was it part of the beginning of the dinosaur project?
I don't think it was part of the dinosaur project. What we're talking about here, the key thing that you sent me, the key comment was that this system had five nuclear weapons on board.
Correct.
And that there were facilities so that four guys could stay in space for, well, a month, 30 days, something like that.
That is correct.
And we need a little historical context here. When the Russians and the United States were going at each other in the beginning of the Cold War, as nuclear weapons were developed and the United States got caught a little bit short, the Russians were much faster at jumping on the nuclear bandwagon than anybody expected them to be. The head of the program, the general who was in charge of the Manhattan Project, thought in 1948 it would take the Russians 8 years before they exploded their first nuclear weapon. So what do we have to worry about? Besides, they don't even have a means for reaching us. Well, it took them only a year after that. 1949
exactly.
was the first Soviet nuclear weapon. And they developed ICBMs, and people forget the reason we went to the moon was to show that we're as good as the Russians, because they had the first satellite, they had the first flight around the moon, they had the first animal in space, the first man in space, the first woman in space, the first to see the other side of the moon. We were getting creamed. And so the program, the Apollo program was set up. But along the way, there were negotiations going on, as they both recognized that mutually assured destruction didn't seem a great way for the world to proceed. You hit me, I'll hit you back, and we'll both get destroyed. That doesn't make sense for any government. And I should mention that there was this enormous increase in the power of the nuclear weapons. The first one released the energy of about 16,000 tons of dynamite. That's in 1945. The first H-bomb in 1952 released the energy of 10 million tons of dynamite. And the Russians set off one a few years later that released the energy of 57 million tons of dynamite. One stinking weapon. And I use that term advisedly. I don't like nuclear weapons. So
how does that Mark IV program that Dave in New Jersey mentioned, how does that fit into...
Well, because there was an agreement reached, that program planned to have nuclear weapons in space with a crew ready to release one on the other guy if the need arose. Because how could you do anything about a guy going around the planet with nuclear weapons on board and sitting just waiting.
Right, like a doomsday plan. A doomsday
Wasn't that
plan.
In 62 or 63 that the U.S. and Russia came to that agreement, though?
Well, there was a preliminary agreement, then there was a later agreement. This stretched out over a period of time. But they finally did agree on the concept of mutually assured destruction. And the system you were talking about, the funding did not proceed for developing such systems. And it's one example, and there aren't many, of countries on this planet trying to do what was sensible.
Okay, I want to work it back into the UFO field, if I could. Dave in New Jersey, thank you for that. I'm glad you had a chance to speak with Stanton. Victor.
No, thank you for letting me get back on the air, and thank you, Dr. Friedman. It's been a real pleasure.
Mister, please, thank you.
The idea of a cadre of people, Stanton and Kathleen, that you've identified very clearly, that seem to have made it their business to debunk everything to do with this issue. I don't want to necessarily get into personalities, but the whole idea of a group of people in an almost orchestrated way gets together to debunk this issue. How did you deal with that in this revelation in the book?
Well, one of the things was we found, much to my surprise, I discovered letters from Dr. Donald Howard Menzel to President John F. Kennedy saying that there's one area he may be of assistance to him. This is after Kennedy was elected in 1960. I've had a longer continuous association with the National Security Agency of anybody, about 30 years. And when we are properly cleared to each other, I can tell you more. Now, the kicker here is Menzel was a total debunker, everybody thought, about UFOs. And nobody knew about this connection with the NSA, of all people. It turns out Menzel was a world-class cryptologist, also in secret. I found this material. I had to get permission from three different people to look at his files at Harvard. And so that was a real shocker. Here we have the top debunker who was trying to tell the Air Force he could explain all sightings. Don't worry about it. Leave it alone. I'll do it for you. And then we find out, after he was dead, that he was a member of the NSA and did all kinds of highly classified work for government agencies. So you start looking around then when you realize, hey, some of these guys had a big, deep background in highly classified stuff that we didn't know anything about. And then you also find evidence that they're making comments. Phil Klass was attacking UFOs all the time. He was going to have a prosaic explanation for all cases. And I get a great laugh at my lectures when I show a copy of his check to me for $1,000 for proving him wrong about the Majestic 12 program documents, the typeface. Now, here's the kicker. How could a guy who's smart, and Phil was smart, and worked for Aviation Week and Space Technology, claim that the NSC, National Security Council, used only elite type in their documents back in the 50s? How could he claim that when I found out later he had never been to the Eisenhower Library? They have 250,000 pages of NSC documents. I found many examples of the same typeface. He was giving me $100 each up to a maximum of 10. Now, the ludicrousness of that claim, when he'd never even been to the library, never seen these documents, he'd gotten 10 documents by mail. I don't know how many he got, but he showed 10 that were done in the elite type. But that's typical of the mystery here. Why did these guys, Menzel, I can understand, he was working under national security. Dr. Edward U. Condon, we talk about at some length. How could he make such ludicrous statements? I mean, he was a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He was elected president of the American Physical Society, president of another big scientific organization. Kathy, you've got this down pat. What was his ridiculous statement about?
This is in his book on the Condon Report. And yes, he made the statement, quote, "It is safe to assume that no intelligent life outside our solar system has any possibility of visiting Earth any time in the next 10,000 years.
Now, how could any scientist make such a stupid claim? We can't predict 100 years in advance, no less 10,000. He knew better than that.
But it was almost like it was a cottage industry, Stan. You know, these people were just setting something up, and they were sort of like just watching the parade go by and commenting on it and doing everything they can do in their power to say, well, there's really nothing to it, but, you know, wink, 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 we all know there really is.
And we found that they were all connected to each other, and all of the information, the important information, was in the correspondence files between the men who were cooperating in disinforming the public about UFOs. They were collaborating together to make sure that scientists did not take part in UFO conferences or debates. They wanted it completely separated from the scientific community. There had been a great deal of scientific interest in all of this up to that point, but it became taboo, and it remains taboo. They were highly successful in the work that they did, and what our book does is it shows the interwoven pattern of these men, their conversations, the way they went about disinforming the public and making sure that no federal funding was ever given again for the scientific study of UFOs.
All right, Stanton and Kathleen, thank you so much for spending an hour with us. It goes by too quickly. I appreciate your time. Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, The Truth Behind the Misinformation, Distortion, and Derision by Debunkers, Government Agencies, and Conspiracy Con Men. Thank you to you both.
Thanks. Check our website.
Thanks for having us on.
Give us the website quickly.
StantonFriedman.com.
And Kathleen-Marden.com.
All right. Thank you to you both. Victor Vigiani, thank you as always.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. My website, StrangePlanet.ca. That's your portal to this program. Say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. S-Y because I love you. R-E-T-T. And as always, follow the truth.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Live from Toronto, Canada, Earth, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
And thanks for inviting me into your home, your long-haul truck, taxi, RV, camper, your parents' basement, loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. A special welcome to all of you listening in on our flagship station, Zoomer Radio, AM 740 and 96.7 FM. Hello to all of you listening to the podcast on Stitcher Radio, TuneIn.com, iTunes, TalkZone.com. The affiliates, of course, across North America, from Alaska to Lubbock, Texas. The Zoomer Radio app and the Conspiracy Show app, both free downloads. And, of course, those of you streaming us live on YouTube through our Hangout On Air, HOA, however and wherever you're listening, I bid thee the warmest of welcomes and I thank you for your fine company. A plasma physicist, John Brandenburg, author of Death on Mars, is standing by to discuss evidence for an ancient civilization on Mars and its destruction in a massive nuclear holocaust. First, let me say hello to Ian Robertson, our technical producer, Albert Vinzel, our story producer and occasional remote viewer, and of course, Victor Vigiani, executive director of Zealand Communications News Network, the website zlandcommunications.blogspot.ca. Hello, Victor.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Richard. Looking forward to this show.
Indeed. Indeed we are. Let's get right to it, shall we? John Brandenburg, a PhD, is a plasma physicist. He did his graduate work in California at Lawrence Livermore National Lab in controlled plasmas for fusion power, and he has worked in defense, energy, and space research. Dr. Brandenburg was also part of the Clementine mission to the moon, which discovered water at the moon's poles. However, the focus of his scientific career has been to complete the great effort of Einstein to unify the two long-range forces of nature, gravity and electromagnetism. His new book is Death on Mars. John, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Oh, I'm just great, and it's a great honor to be on your show, sir.
A real pleasure. Well, this is, I was going to say earth-shattering, but I guess we should say Mars-shattering. This,
no doubt about that.
The fact that you're like you're
I'm glad we can laugh about it.
well, you know what they say: time plus tragedy plus time equals comedy. But we're talking 250 million years. I think
we can laugh at it by now.
Yeah, but the idea that you are presenting this stuff to the Pentagon. That's me. This information. This evidence.
Well, when we discovered it, when we discovered there were nuclear weapon signatures on Mars, at the urging of Vince DiPietro, my co-worker, who was one of the original researchers on the face in Cydonia, the D&M pyramid, I decided we had to inform the Pentagon, and we were able to do that through a back channel. And we briefed a representative of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he was very sober and took careful notes, and said they'd get back to us through channels, and about 6 months later, they got back to me and said, and as usual with the U.S. intelligence community, their response to my question was a question. I said, well, what should I do about this? And they said, why don't you publish it? And so I began to figure out how to get this into the mainstream scientific literature. One way I looked at was that on Earth there were natural nuclear reactors in Africa operating about 1 billion years ago, and these were a very natural event. Groundwater got into very rich uranium deposits and started a natural nuclear reactor going, with the uranium ore being very much enriched with uranium-235 in those days. It's 1 billion years ago. So I hypothesized that it occurred on Mars. However, as I presented that at scientific conferences, and that ended up as a Wikipedia article, by the way. I get honorable mention there on natural nuclear reactors. People pointed out that it was giving the wrong signature for a nuclear reactor, which has moderated neutrons, low-energy neutrons. This would not produce what we saw on Mars, only a fast neutron reaction, as in a nuclear weapon, would produce it. We also found then two big radioactive scars on Mars, one in a place called Mare Acidalium near Cydonia, and the other one in Utopia Planitia, which happens to be near a other site of what looks like archaeology on Mars called Galaxias Chaos. These are NASA-assigned names.
Excuse me, John, what is a radioactive scar exactly?
It's an area of Mars that is more radioactive than the surroundings. And I have a web page up called lifeonmars.pub, and people can visit that and they can see all of the data I have laid out. And on Mars, there's two areas of radioactive potassium, and then there are also those same areas, there's also radioactive thorium, which is a naturally radioactive element. And what's interesting is in the center of those areas is a lot of glass, as if like a kind of a volcanic glass, but it's been etched by acid. And this is also, this is detected by infrared light. Glass gives a special reflectance in infrared light. And they discovered that this matches what's called trinitite, which is a type of glass created in nuclear explosions by dust being pulled up into the fireball of a nuclear weapon going off. What's also interesting is there are no craters at these sites.
Why is that significant?
It indicates that whatever happened went off in midair. It was not a, if it had been a natural nuclear reactor, it would have gone off under the ground in some kind of uranium deposit or something like that, and it would have created a large crater. Instead, there is no crater. There's only a broad, shallow depression. And this is typical of what you call an airburst in nuclear weapons terminology. You must understand, I went to school to study nuclear fusion energy, and part of the time I spent studying laser fusion, which is creating a miniature hydrogen bomb. And so I ended up working down at the end of the lab where they did nuclear weapons design. In fact, I was had the dubious honor of being there when they invented the neutron bomb. And you had to understand the mindset. So I learned a lot about nuclear weapons from just working there. And the guys down the hall told me, John, the neutron bomb is great because it only destroys people.
Right.
Leaves all the valuable
exactly.
Cars, buildings.
That is indeed interesting mindset.
Sitting there as a graduate student drinking my coffee and smiling and nodding.
Isn't technology grand? Yes.
Some people get a little too close to the problem and it becomes a blind spot to them. They lose the big picture view of it. In any case, so I had become quite familiar with nuclear weapons, the basic physics and design of nuclear weapons, while I was at Livermore. And what happens in a hydrogen bomb is a fission bomb usually is used to set off the hydrogen reaction. A small atomic bomb compresses a ball of hydrogen isotopes or hydrogen lithium isotopes. You can read about this all on Wikipedia, by the way. And it used to be classified, but now it isn't. And the ball is compressed and basically turns into a star, or rather kind of a miniature supernova. And then what they do is they wrap the outer casing of the bomb with uranium or thorium. And the neutrons released by the hydrogen reaction are very powerful and very energetic, and they actually fission the normally inert uranium-238 and thorium, thus doubling the violence of the explosion, the explosive yield. And this creates an enormous amount of fallout, but it's also a cheap way to double the yield of your hydrogen bomb. And so a standard hydrogen bomb in the arsenals of all the major nations on Earth is basically a mixed hydrogen fission reaction. And that appears to, that creates an enormous amount of an isotope called xenon-129. It's a one of the family of isotopes of xenon, and it's characteristic of fast neutron reactions, as in a bomb or special reactors used to make plutonium.
And it would have a half-life of at least 250 million years?
Oh, no, the xenon-129 is actually stable. It will be around at the end of the universe. Many people worry about, you know, of course, the radioactive isotopes created by nuclear explosions, but this isotope is actually stable. So it bears witness even a billion years after the fact.
And so how are you estimating that it's 250 million years ago that this nuclear explosion?
That is based on, appears to be the time when the climate on Mars changed from being Earth-like to what it is now. The ocean on Mars appears to have lasted until about a quarter of a billion years ago.
And the atmosphere was there until about...
In order to have a liquid ocean, you had to have a dense atmosphere, and the greenhouse effect caused by a dense CO2 atmosphere to make the water liquid. And also we have... that's just a rough estimate, though. We have a... one meteorite from Mars that is heavily bombarded with neutrons, and it's 180 million years old, and it's a lava sandwich. It's actually two lava flows fused together that were apparently very close in age, and one of them shows heavy marks of irradiation, the other one doesn't. So approximately 180 million years ago to 250 million years ago appears to be the time frame that this occurred.
All right. What's a quarter billion years among friends?
I know. Well,
we'll take a time out, John. We'll get back into this in a big way. John Brandenburg, plasma physicist, author of Death on Mars. Victor Vigiani in studio. More in a moment right here on The Conspiracy Show.
The truth is not out there. It's right here. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett. From Zoomer Radio. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. If you're sure your phone isn't tapped, call now. 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
John Brandenburg is with us, plasma physicist and the author of Death on Mars. And he says there is clear evidence of a nuclear holocaust taking place on the Red Planet some 250 million years ago. Who had nuclear weapons 250 million years ago? That's the obviously the million-dollar question. Let me work Victor Vigiani in here.
Yeah, actually, that's the one of the points that I want to try to broach. In a sense, John, your research, John, says that this is a unique event. You know, it happened in a certain specific way in two places on Mars. It wasn't something that just sort of happened as a natural set of...
there's no known phenomena that can create this. Natural phenomenon.
Yeah. So the only other logical, unless I'm taking a different position here, someone had to create those conditions.
Yes.
And so does that not allude to the existence of something? Let's leave that there for a second and go back to the whole idea of your communication with the Pentagon and their acceptance of the fact that you should actually publish. Is that not a tacit admission that something's going on here, that they want to release it through a back door or something? How's that working?
I've spent a great deal of time thinking what were their motivations. I was somebody working for the U.S. government at the time as a contractor, and if they had said, Dr. Brandenburg, you've stumbled on something classified, please don't talk about it to anybody, I would have just naturally accepted that. Instead, they basically waved me ahead. Apparently, they want this to come out, and the U.S. government has apparently known about this since 1976. I'm pleased to hear this is conspiracy radio. I didn't think Canadians believed in conspiracy theories.
Oh, no, no.
Most Americans view that the Canadians are much more psychologically healthy than we are.
Well, we're working on it.
It must be, paranoia must be contagious. But anyway, the U.S. government has known about this since, at least as a possibility, since about 1976, when we landed with the two Viking probes. And they sampled the atmosphere and found the Xenon 129, and which is a clear indicator. I've shown this to other nuclear physicists who are, you know, familiar with the forensics of nuclear weapons. You know, reconstructing nuclear weapons from residues in the atmosphere, and they agree with me. What's also interesting is Stanton Friedman, the guest on just the previous hour, has also looked at this and agrees with me. He says any alien visiting this planet would know that from sampling our atmosphere that we've set off a lot of nuclear weapons. So I regard that as, of course, I've always felt Stanton was a gentleman and a scholar, but I was very heartened by his support in this. And he is a trained nuclear physicist. I'm a plasma physicist. Basically, I learned a lot of nuclear physics, but my major focus was plasmas. However, what's interesting is the two sites of the what appears to have been the nuclear explosions that happened midair. And by the way, that's like Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They did not leave big craters at Hiroshima and Nagasaki when the bombs went off. And that was not done for humanitarian reasons. That was done to maximize the blast effect in the atmosphere. But if you look downwind of both sites, where the strongest shock waves and the strongest fallout would have fallen, it's Cydonia Mensa and another site called Galaxias Chaos in the Utopia Planitia Basin. And both of these are discussed in the online articles that you can find on the net and also in the book Death on Mars. And there at Galaxias Chaos, there's another large face, carved face, similar to the one in Cydonia. And we have known about that one since about 1984 and published that.
LifeOnMars.pub is the website. LifeOnMars.pub.
Like English pub, yes.
Do you have reason then to believe that this is... You know, why they sent the rover back up there to collect further data?
Yeah, they have carefully avoided the areas of actual, you know, where we found archaeological remains. By the way, the civilization on Mars looks as though it was primitive, humanoid, and And of course, it is dead now. And one reason I believe the U.S. government is allowing this to come out is because this is the best way to break it to the break the news to humanity that we're not alone in the universe, and that the universe is can sometimes be a very dangerous place.
Well, if someone had nukes 250 million years ago, I don't even want to go there. I mean, in terms of what they would have now in terms of the capability.
Well, whoever did this, I think, is long gone. The civilization on Mars that was targeted, I mean, people don't drop these enormous hydrogen bombs out of space and have them explode on midair for no reason. Apparently, they were targeting somebody, and the target was a what appears to have been a very primitive kind of Bronze Age civilization who carved faces, large faces, that were humanoid. I mean, they don't have big fangs or horns on their head or anything like that. They look like pretty they look somewhat similar to human faces. And this is actually the best way. This is actually a godsend. This is the best way to break it to the public on Earth that we are not alone in the universe. There are other people out there. And by, you know, finding a dead civilization, a dead humanoid primitive civilization, this is absolutely no threat. No, it presents no threat to the human race. It's just basically a passive object of study. Now, the fact that somebody dropped hydrogen bombs on Mars but is long gone suggests that the universe can be a very dangerous place. We already knew that. We know that a comet or asteroid could plow into the Earth and destroy all of humanity if we're not careful. So I've looked at various scenarios for that the government could employ to kind of break it to the people that we're not alone in the universe. One of the ideas is, you know, discovering an alien broadcast from some other star. And, however, as Carl Sagan explored in his novel Contact, I'm sure you saw the movie and or read the novel.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
This created a crisis on Earth because there was, you know, there was division over whether we should respond to the broadcast that we were receiving, and of course it sent us plans to build a machine, and this created a lot of anxiety on Earth. So it created a crisis, and the U.S. government and of course the governments of the other superpowers don't want a crisis. They want to find like a dead civilization that we can study, and it's primitive, it's dead, and it was humanoid. Looks like us, at least roughly. And this is the very best way to break it to the people that intelligent life exists elsewhere in the universe by finding it on a nearby planet.
So it's the soft sell, I guess, what you're saying.
It's a soft landing for the human race.
What sort of...
Non-threatening.
Yeah. What sort of indications do you have... or have you had since your lecture at, I think it was the Aeronautics Institute?
Yeah, there's a space conference.
Right,
in,
yeah.
In 2016 space conference put on by the American Institute of Aeronautics mm-hmm. and Astronautics.
How did the people respond?
California. It's quite a prestigious conference, mm-hmm. and they allowed me to present it.
How did the people respond to your data?
The response was stunned. They were stunned. The room was packed. They bombarded me with questions afterwards.
A general
accept. There was some fear I could see on some people's faces. Most of them, especially the younger students, were just mesmerized. They had never seen all this evidence laid out in this way. I was a scientist speaking to a room full of other scientists and engineers, mm-hmm. and it was the response was quite gratifying.
Was there any sort of instances of no, the data could be sort of skewed this way or skewed that way? It doesn't seem to be the provocative opinion.
I did not encounter anybody. None of the questions no one asked a question like this. Well, one person said, you know, is there some natural explanation for these isotopes? And, you know, the ensemble of evidence, I would say there is no known natural phenomenon that could cause this. You know, the molten glass at the sites, the radioactive scars, the fact that the meteorites we get from Mars, some of the younger ones show intense irradiation by neutrons, and, of course, the isotopes in the atmosphere. There is no known natural phenomenon that can cause this array of effects that, you know, that is known. It could be some completely unknown astrophysical phenomenon, maybe a blob of antimatter fell in from space and exploded on Mars, or two of them. But nothing we've ever seen can do anything like this that was natural. The only thing known is what we set off on Earth, only on a, this is a, these would have been weapons as big as the Empire State Building dropped onto Mars from space.
Is it time now to start looking elsewhere in our galactic backyard for signatures of a nuclear holocaust? I'm thinking, you know.
Well, the only reason we've been able to do this is they have investigated Mars so thoroughly in the last two decades. And part of the reason that Mars has been the target of such intensive investigation is because, I believe, because of the work of DiPietro and Molinar in discovering the Cydonia face and the pyramid. And mainstream scientists will say, oh, no, it had nothing to do with it. Mars has always been fascinating. No, before they discovered the pyramid and the face was investigated in, you know, two good images of the face at Cydonia by DiPietro and Molinar, people had basically said, oh, well, Mars isn't interesting anymore. It's just like the moon. It's dead. We're going to move on to Europa, you know, the big moon of Saturn that starred in the science fiction movie 2010.
Right.
And that's what people's attitude was, that the large planets, Jupiter and Saturn were, and of course the moon Titan, were far more interesting than Mars was. But because of DiPietro and Molinar making such a big fuss about the Cydonia, Mars suddenly became the most valuable piece of real estate in the solar system.
I'm just thinking of Joseph Farrell and his book, The Cosmic Wars, and evidence, possible evidence for nuclear warfare elsewhere in the galaxy.
Well, it could be there is evidence that it may have occurred on Earth.
Right. Well, yes, we can talk about Robert Oppenheimer when he was asked, you know, is this the first time a bomb has been detonated? And he said, yes, in modern times.
That's right.
Then there's the question of Venus. Why does it spin the other way? You know, is it possible, a nuclear blast?
We're surrounded by mysteries, and once you accept the idea that we're not alone in the universe, that there are other intelligent beings that would have similar passions as our own, then you have to look at everything with new eyes.
Indeed. Listen, I've got to take a time out. We'll come back and we'll look at some more things with new eyes. John Brandenburg, author of Death on Mars, Victor Vigiani in studio. Stay with us.
Keeping an eye on the new world order. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-740-4740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. You want the truth? You can handle the truth. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To get the truth, call Richard now at 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
Dr. John Brandenburg, Death on Mars is the book, and the website, the website again, John, is lifeonmars.pub.
Lifeonmars.pub.
All right.
All one word.
Evidence of a nuclear holocaust on the red planet 250 million years ago. We had the Drake equation, which attempted to estimate, you know, how much how many other civilizations might be out there. Well, and then in response to that, we had Enrico Fermi's paradox, which says, you know, why aren't they here? Well, you may have nailed down the answer.
Well, maybe the really and truly intelligent species out there keep a low profile.
Well, or if they had,
unlike us human beings who are basically holding a rock concert and with a huge bonfire, we're holding basically a Burning Man celebration in the middle of this ghost town that is the universe as we understand it. I mean, anyone out there who is looking for somebody like us could find us. The estimates are now, by the way, that we could detect ourselves within 100 light years. If somebody was 100 light years from us who had similar technology as ourselves, they could detect us.
Hmm.
We make so much radio noise.
But if they had nukes 250 million years ago and they weren't afraid to use them, maybe you know, they just didn't survive.
I'm sure cosmic karma caught up with them eventually. You have to figure that. They certainly haven't been back here to polish us off. We're still fine. I don't believe you can get away with doing things like that. I just don't believe it. I also write science fiction, so I've kind of tried to kind of wrap my mind away around the entire cosmos, the way it may run out there. I wrote a novel called Morningstar Pass, The Collapse of the UFO Cover-Up. I wrote under a pen name, Victor Norgaard, and it's based on the rumors I heard in Washington, D.C. when I worked there.
Well, that's what I'd like to broach for a second.
Sure.
Is the idea that you've been having your work sanctioned and legitimized by the Pentagon in publishing it and being
well,
able
not,
to,
not officially.
Well, it'd be backdoor,
quiet way.
Whatever that function is. Would you sense that there could be some sort of progress towards more of this kind of behavior? Is there a plan in place? Have you heard something that's going to be happening next? Like, the whole motivation of this is absolutely fascinating.
Well, if you may have seen the superb science fiction movie Arrival recently.
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm itching to.
It's very good, and you know, one of the theories in the community of us who believes that, you know, the government is aware of extraterrestrial presence out there is that this movie looks like it was kind of preparing the public for some kind of announcement or something.
You're connecting the dots, I guess, huh?
I guess I'm just connecting the dots. I complained to a friend of mine who's a ufologist. I said, Don, his name is Don Ecker, and he's a really smart guy. And I said, Don, the problem with this field is there are no facts. There are only reports, rumors. We're just sort of connecting the dots. That movie was basically, I think, preparing the public for an announcement that we're not alone in the universe.
Are you following the work of Robert Hastings and Robert Salas in regards to the nuclear shutdowns? These craft, these people, these beings, or whatever they're reporting,
well,
they really like to hang around these places and shut down the machinery.
Well, I've heard many reports of that. However, the government in this country went to great lengths to make sure that people couldn't do things like that. Because if somebody from outer space can do it, the Russians might be able to do it. And in order to keep nuclear deterrence effective, you had to have a credible strike force. It may be the government learned from whatever happened how to prevent that. There were certainly no the reports of shutdowns that I've heard were always isolated incidents at specific sites that maybe, you know, two or three nuclear weapon systems were shut down. And I also heard one very fascinating report
Maybe I'll get you to hold on to that, Dr. Brandenburg, sure. And we'll pick up on that on the other side. LifeOnMars.pub is the website. Evidence for a nuclear holocaust on the Red Planet 250 million years ago. More with John and Victor Vigiani in studio right after this.
Exploring theories, uncovering facts, and offering a different view of the universe. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard live, call 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Corporations, governments, and sometimes entire civilizations. What goes up must come down. And it lands on The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
John Brandenburg stays with us. LifeOnMars.pub, the website. Victor Vigiani in studio. Zealand News Network. And it's zealandcommunications.blogspot.ca. John, I mentioned earlier Robert Oppenheimer of being heard off mic. I don't know if this is an apocryphal story or not, but was asked, after, I guess it was the detonation at Trinity, whether this is the first detonation of a nuclear bomb. And he said, supposedly, yes, in modern times.
Yes.
First of all, what are your thoughts? I mean, there has been some suggestion that there was that there is evidence of ancient nuclear war in places like the Indus Valley in India.
I guess it's Yando Daro area. There's a which means just Hill of the Dead in what is presently Pakistan in the Indus Valley. There is evidence of the same kind of trinitite glass. And there's the account in the Hindu scriptures of what looks like an extraterrestrial colony, which then had a civil war, separated into two factions, which then had a nuclear war between them. And when they did excavations at that as an archaeological site, they found large numbers of unburied bodies lying in the streets of the ruins that hadn't even been molested by scavengers, wild dogs, which are very common there, indicating that they, consistent with them being radioactive, the whole site being so radioactive that not even wild dogs could venture there to prey on the dead.
What's the timeline on that? 12,000 years ago?
Yes, I would say probably 10,000 years ago. It's funny, you can't find a lot of information about that site. The Indian and Pakistani governments kind of kept it quiet, and the British government before that was running the place just kept it quiet. And so I'm sure that Oppenheimer was aware of that, and so it's a, we have to look at everything with new eyes now. We have to realize that the human race is not the most despicable thing in the universe. Apparently, we're just part of its fabric. I explore this in the novel Morningstar Pass, which has its comic moments. There are two heroines who are they're newscasters on a network like Fox News or CNN, and of course they're both very attractive, of course. One is Asian, one is Jewish and Ukrainian. And they are then become privy to all these government documents being leaked by somebody about the UFO cover-up. So they investigate, and they're talking to abductees. They finally conclude that the rest of the universe is just as screwed up as this planet.
maybe even more.
I feel much better now. Thank you for that.
Yes, I know.
It's so nice to be normal, isn't it?
Being American, we're used to being blamed for everything.
Of course. Yeah. I wonder if you could share your thoughts on this whole idea of, like, and I keep on going back to it again, is the planets in place. And, number one, have you ever been cautioned about what to say or not to say on one hand? And how will this eventually play out in the mainstream? I really want to know more about that.
I believe it'll eventually just be discussed quite widely in the open, in the mainstream press. The fact that they, you know, I was allowed to come and give a paper on it at a fairly high-profile space conference indicated that it passed all of the normal places where people would have veto power. The powers that be would have had veto power over it, and instead, and in fact, I presented evidence for the just the anomalous nuclear explosions at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in 2015. And that was allowed in. People came and argued with me, and one fellow, though, after looking at all of the evidence, just asked me, well, did they do it to themselves or did somebody else do it?
How do you feel that the new administration might look at this information, or do they have a role at all in how they're participating in this?
Every time you get a new administration, there's generally they reexamine everything with new eyes. The Obama administration tended to be kind of more introspective. They weren't very interested in human spaceflight, for instance. They were more interested in things like global warming and things like that. Those are scientific issues, which are certainly very important. So their emphasis was more on the plight of the Earth rather than going into outer space. I mean, you really, and traditionally, the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, which the presidency represented, was very much concerned with the internal dynamics of the United States and, you know, making that run better if they could, and kind of withdraw. They were interested maybe in academic kind of views of outer space, but certainly not not astronauts charging around. That was always viewed as an extravagance.
Sort of a navel gazing rather than looking beyond.
My sense is Trump wants to go back to the moon.
Yes, your words, I would agree. I would agree with that characterization. But you know, the problems of environmental change, I consider to be very real. We have to deal with that in
sure.
some rational manner.
But John, my sense is, I may have read this somewhere or heard it, but that Trump is game to go back to the moon.
Yes, I have heard that, and I view that is a much better outlook than we have had. But of course, I'm a space guy. I will say that the only rational response to what we are finding on Mars is that we must become a spacefaring people. We cannot just sit here on this planet and wait to be discovered by somebody else.
Any thoughts on...
We have to go to Mars. We have to find out what happened. Was this some very unknown, weird astrophysical phenomenon that occurred on Mars? Was it an attack by one species onto a more primitive species? Was Mars more Earth-like in the past, as all of this suggests, and then it was destroyed? We have to go up there, and we have to send people up there. You could drive rovers around. Any archaeologist will tell you you could drive a rover, Mars rover, around on an archaeological site for years and not find anything except piles of rubble.
Are you familiar?
You have to dig.
Are you familiar, John, with the new Ron Howard production called Mars? It's a two. It's fascinating.
I'm not familiar with the details of it. Do they find some remains of a dead civilization or something?
No, actually, it's a story of how a corporation took over in America and sent a vehicle to Mars with a contingent of about 10 people, and how they got there, while they landed, and the travails they're going through while they're there. They really haven't gotten into that. It's only been two episodes so far, but
let me tell you, it's
riveting. It's absolutely riveting.
That's very interesting. I guess I've been a little distracted by everything. To me, you know, there was the idea of the Cydonia face being a remains of a civilization in mission to Mars, but the most people like Ron Howard tend to avoid things like that. But you know, I do believe that this will be, I believe, very soon discussed widely in the mainstream media.
Well, you were asked to publish by the Pentagon. Now you've done that. So
right.
Did you go back to them? Did you return their serve?
No, what's interesting was one of the people that I dealt with at the time has now retired from the intelligence agency he worked for. He showed up at one of the first presentations of this. I presented it at the Mars Society meeting in Houston, Texas. And he showed up just for the.
Wow!
So I saw him there, and I took him out. And we had a few beers in the local bar and discussed things. And he watched with some amusement while I showed. I had a private viewing room where I could show people the entire hypothesis, and I showed a number of visiting scientists, particularly from Russia. And he was sitting there drinking a glass of wine, watching all of this, obviously with approval. No one has told me to be quiet about this at all.
Is there also some sort of movement towards a potential international flavor to all of this?
I was sitting there at the space conference in Long Beach, and the astronauts, a panel of astronauts and NASA officials, and then an official from the European Space Agency, and I think someone from the Russian space program, not Soviet, the Russian space program, they were talking about that any mission to Mars would be based around the space station consortium, which is very international. And the U.S. Manned spaceflight program and human spaceflight program is entirely geared now to coordinating with the Russians on everything. Now, I do not believe that will change under the Trump administration.
Very quickly, how do you feel about terraforming the Red Planet?
Oh, eventually I believe we could do that. We will be basically resuscitating a planet that was similar to ourselves. I think terraforming is a little less precise than basically resuscitating Mars to being a living, vital planet like it used to be.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to have you back because I know you're an authority on the moon, and that's kind of a favorite subject of mine, whether or not it's, in fact, artificial. We'll get into that next time if you're good for that job.
I think it's a ball of rock myself. It's not made of green cheese, however.
No, but there's some amazing coincidences, as you well know.
Yes, it is an unusual. We are certainly blessed to have this nice moon.
It's just too perfect. All right, my thanks to Ian Robertson, Albert Vinzel.
Thank you Victor, so much for having me on.
Thank you,
show.
John Brandenburg. Appreciate your time. Victor Vigiani, to you as well. Back next week. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night. Thank you.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.